Hello and welcome to The Ballpark, a podcast from the Phelan U.S. Center here at the London School of Economics. I'm Chris Gilson, Managing Editor of the Phelan U.S. Center's blog on U.S. politics and policy, USAP. In November 2024, I spoke to Professor Kishore Mahbubani, Distinguished Fellow at the Asia Research Institute at the National University of Singapore. From 1971 until 2004, he was a diplomat with the Singapore Foreign Service. He served as Singapore's ambassador to the UN from 1984 to 1989, and then again from 1998 to 2004, and also as president of the UN Security Council in January 2001 and May 2002. In 2004, he was appointed the founding dean of the Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy. He is a prolific author, publishing books including 2001's Can Asians Think? Understanding the Divide Between East and West, and in 2020, Has China Won? The Chinese Challenge to American Primacy. We spoke about the evolving relationships between Asian countries and the US, the India-China relationship, and the role of Southeast Asia within the greater context of US-China relations. Well, thank you so much for joining us on The Ballpark today. Could you just start by briefly introducing yourself and your professional and academic journey and talk a bit about what you're doing now? Thank you.
Well, I would say in terms of my professional journey, there have been three phases. In the first phase, immediately after graduating from the National University of Singapore in 1971, I spent 33 years as a diplomat with postings in Phnom Penh during the war, Malaysia, Washington, D.C., and New York twice as ambassador to UN. And then I went on to become, in 2004, the founding dean of the Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy at the National University of Singapore for 13 years. And since in the last 7 years, since I stepped down as dean, I've continued to produce books. So I've now published 10 books. And one of my recent ones, The Asian 21st Century, was downloaded 3.8 million times as an open access book. So I guess I can describe myself as a writer too now.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much. So, as you said, across your career, you've held numerous senior positions in the Singapore Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and including as president of the UN Security Council, while also serving as the Singapore Permanent Representative to the United Nations. Looking back on your time as a diplomat, how do you chart the evolving relationship and understandings between Asian countries on the one hand and the Western world, particularly the United States, on the other? Thank you.
Well, I would say it's been an evolving relationship. And since my professional career began in 1971, there have been three phases in the relations between the West and Asia. I think phase one was very clear and very predictable, and that was the Cold War between the United States and Soviet Union. And I would say most of the states in Asia worked with the United States, and that's why there's a lot of reservoir goodwill, for example, in Southeast Asia, towards the United States. But at the same time, one of the paradoxical aspects of that time was that the world's largest democracy, India, was alienated from the United States, and the world's largest autocracy was allied with the United States in the Cold War. And then, of course, you had the post-Cold War period, which was a patchy, jumpy period. And I've also described in my writings, the United States and much of the Western world became quite arrogant after the collapse of the Soviet Union, with this belief that the West had reached the end of history and the rest of the world had to become carbon copies of the West. And that's when there was a lot of resistance in Asia to those Western ideas. That was phase two. But now we are moving into what I call phase three, which is a completely different world that's emerging today. I call it the 3M world. The 3M stands for multi-civilizational, multipolar, and multilateral. And it's multi-civilizational because we no longer have one single dominant civilization, the Western civilization as we had in the past. Other civilizations are emerging. And it's multipolar because it's no longer either unipolar or bipolar world. Lots of new powers are emerging, including, for example, in addition to the United States and China, India is clearly emerging as a powerful third pole in the world. And it's multilateral because there are lots of new multilateral organizations emerging to counterbalance the Western international architecture. So, for example, you have the BRICS organization, which is growing and expanding and certainly becoming more influential than, say, the G7, which used to be the most powerful international group for a long time.
In 2001, you published a book called Can Asians Think? Understanding the Divide Between East and West. Looking back on the more than two decades since that book, what would you say are the key divides that you saw at the time? And how would you reflect on how the divides you identified back then have changed or gotten wider between the West and the East? Thank you.
Well, the key reason why I published Can Asians Think? Was to actually counterbalance Western arrogance and hubris at the end of the Cold War. And basically, one of the key messages I was trying to pose by asking the question, can Asians think, was can Asians think for themselves and decide what's good or what's bad for them? And perhaps they may not necessarily become carbon copies of the West. And what's interesting about that book, which is a book of essays that I've written from the early 1990s, is that a long time ago, over 30 years ago, I predicted the return of Asia. And I said that Asian societies would emerge and become stronger and stronger. Fortunately or unfortunately, my predictions have come true. For example, let me give you one statistic to illustrate how much things have changed. In 1980, the combined GNP of the European Union countries was at least 10 times bigger than China, 10 times bigger. Now, the combined GNP, the European Union countries, is about the same size as China. And by 2050, China will be twice the size of the European Union. So you can see this is an amazing power transition that is taking place. The European Union has gone from being 10 times bigger to becoming the same size as China and becoming half the size in 20 to 25 years. And what is shocking is that many Europeans, including European leaders like Ursula von der Leyen, the current foreign minister of Germany, a lady from the Green Party, they're unaware that the global power structure has changed dramatically. And for the era when the Europeans could afford to be condescending towards Asians is over. But the European leaders who got so used to this idea of being condescending when speaking to the rest of the world and even being condescending to the Asian countries, which clearly are doing much better than the European countries in terms of economic growth, haven't changed their habits. And that's why I think the message of the book, Can Asians Think, still remains as relevant as ever. And what is remarkable about this book is that actually it was first published in 1998, and it's still in print after 26 years, showing that the world understands and appreciates the fact that the key messages of Can Asians Think still need to be heeded after 20 over years.
So how does the Singaporean and Southeast Asian perspective view the rise of China and Asia more broadly, especially with regards to how it challenges the liberal international order led by the US? Has this view changed in the decades that you have been observing these relationships, both as a diplomat and as an academic?
Well, I mean, certainly everybody in Asia has got to pay attention to the rise of China. But I want to emphasize, okay, also that the rise of Asia is not just about the rise of China, you know, because the Chinese, of course, have a massive population. They have 1.4 billion people, but the total population of Asia is 4.8 billion people. So the Chinese are still a minority within Asia. And certainly, we got to pay attention to the return of India, which is going to be the big one of the big stories over the next few decades. And equally importantly, one of the most underestimated regions in the whole world is ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. And they have almost 700 million people too. And the ASEAN region has done spectacularly well over the past few decades. So, for example, in the year 2000, around the time when I published Can Asians Think, Japan's economy was the second biggest economy in the world. It was 8 times bigger than ASEAN. Today, Japan's economy is only 1.3 times bigger than ASEAN. And by 2030, ASEAN will be bigger than Japan. Okay, and again, another major power transition that is taking place. But what is important to emphasize here is that most Asian countries are aware that they have actually grown and succeeded because of the post-World War II liberal international order that the United States and the West created after 1945. And today we are in a paradoxical situation whereby some of the biggest defenders of this international rules-based order are in Asia, and whereas some of the countries that have become disillusioned with this rules-based order are in the West. And to give you a concrete example of that, certainly the World Trade Organization and its predecessor organization, which was called GATT, or General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs, were created by the West. And the West always said, hey, open up your economies, trade, and you will thrive and you will do well. But today we are in a very paradoxical situation whereby the leading exponent of the liberal international rules-based order, United States, is now become opposed to the World Trade Organization and is actually going all out to paralyze it by blocking the appointment of judges to the appellate court of WTO, the World Trade Organization. And by contrast, the Asian countries embrace the WTO and want to see it actually strengthened and not weakened today. And equally importantly, when it comes to signing free trade agreements, for a long time, it was the United States that preached the virtues of free trade agreements to the rest of the world and said, you must sign them, they're good for you. Indeed, as recently as President Barack Obama, he launched a trade agreement called the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which he actually negotiated and signed as president. But as soon as he left office in 2016, Donald Trump, as you know, withdrew the United States from the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And today, even the Democrats who were part of the creation of TPP, like former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, has also walked away from the TPP. So you have the paradoxical situation today whereby the Western ideas of a rules-based order are actually embraced by the Asian countries because they've seen that they've grown and thrive in that rules-based order. And it's actually the Western creators that are now either weak or non-defenders of this order. So, for example, the Europeans themselves still believe in trade, still believe in free trade, and would like to trade more, but they are incapable, because Europe has become so weak, incapable of guiding the United States towards supporting the World Trade Organization. So this is the paradoxical state of the world that we have, where Western ideas of a rules-based order are now supported by Asians, but not supported by Westerners.
You published a book entitled Has China Won? The Chinese Challenge to American Primacy in 2020, which looks at this topic. Do you think the actions taken by the West in the last 4 years, such as decoupling and reshoring, effectively address the ways that China has challenged the U.S.?
Well, I think the China challenge is clearly going to be the number one challenge, especially for the United States. You know, Europe has got to make a big decision where it stands in this U.S.-China standoff that is happening. I mean, there's no question whatsoever that the key geopolitical contest that will drive world history over the next 10, 20 years is the geopolitical contest within the world's number one power, which today is the United States of America, and the world's number one emerging power, which today is China. And as I said in the introduction of my book, Has China Won? I wrote it, I published it in January 2020. I said in November 2020, we're going to have elections. We don't know who's going to be the next president, but it doesn't matter. No matter who's the next president, relations between US and China will get worse. And as it turned out, the Americans decided to elect Joe Biden as the American president. In theory, relations could have improved. Number one, Joe Biden is a nice guy. Donald Trump is not a nice guy. Number two, Joe Biden is the first American president to have been elected and assume office with a pre-existing personal relationship with his counterpart. In fact, Xi Jinping and Joe Biden could consider themselves as friends because Joe Biden hosted Xi Jinping when he went to the United States, and Xi Jinping hosted Joe Biden when he went to China. The two men got along very well personally. But, you know, Joe Biden, even though he had criticized the tariffs that Trump had put on China, when he became president, he didn't withdraw any of the tariffs. In fact, he added more tariffs and more sanctions on China, showing that personalities don't matter when it comes to geopolitical contests. So everyone in Asia is realistic enough to know that the US-China geopolitical contest will accelerate over the next 10, 20 years. But at the same time, most Asian states, especially the Southeast Asian states, have made it very clear that unlike in the Cold War, where many Asian states were happy to join a containment policy against the Soviet Union or cut off their ties with the Soviet Union, very few Asian states can afford to cut off their ties or with China or join a containment policy against China. So it shows you, therefore, that the fundamental mistake that the United States is making in its policies towards China is that, and this is an insight given to me by Henry Kissinger in a one-on-one conversation, the biggest mistake the United States is making in dealing with China is that it has launched a contest against China without first working out a comprehensive long-term strategy. And my book, Has China Won, explains in great length why the United States doesn't have a strategy. So at the end of the day, there's a wiser course for the United States to take with China, which is to compete in some areas where there will have to be competition. But at the end of the day, both have to learn to work together because we have more pressing global problems like pandemics, like climate change, like global financial crisis. So I think it's important, therefore, for policymakers in Washington, D.C., to step back and say, maybe, is there a wiser course for the United States to take vis-a-vis China?
Thank you. So you mentioned that in 2020 that it didn't matter a great deal who was elected as president in terms of the U.S.'s relationship with China. We're recording this podcast just a few days before the 2024 presidential election. Do you feel the same way about either Donald Trump or Kamala Harris, depending on if they win, or do you see their administrations, if they are successful, having different policies on China?
Well, one thing is constant, though. Regardless of whether Donald Trump wins or Kamala Harris wins, the pressure on China from the United States will continue, because there's a rock-solid consensus in Washington, D.C. that the United States cannot become the number two economic power in the world. In fact, very few people say that openly, but that's the driving motivation in Washington, D.C., although Joe Biden did say once in an aside, he said, you know, the Chinese want to become the number one economic power in the world, it ain't gonna happen on my watch, said Joe Biden. So clearly, the determination to stop China is well established in both parties. But at the same time, the manner in which US-China relations evolve will, of course, vary quite a bit between Donald Trump and Kamala Harris. In the case of Kamala Harris, you can sort of more or less predict what she's going to do, because it'll probably be a continuation of the sort of pressures that the Biden administration has piled onto China. But in the case of Donald Trump, he's going to be very, very unpredictable. And he could, for example, create a disastrous situation if he proceeds with a 60% tariff on all goods from China. It would be disastrous, by the way, clearly for China. But it could also be disastrous for the United States. And, you know, it could also be disastrous for the world. And I can well imagine the American stock market collapsing as a result of that. And as you know, Donald Trump is very sensitive to the American stock market and to not undermine the fortunes of billionaires like himself. So I think that's when you might see some kind of cost correction that might come in. But nonetheless, with Donald Trump, you just got to get ready for surprises and a rough ride. But one of the surprises could actually be a new deal between the United States and China, because Donald Trump is not ideological in any kind of way. He's a transactional kind of person. So I wouldn't be surprised if he, for example, decides to make a comprehensive deal with China and say, okay, let me know what's important for you. I'll take care of your interests, you take care of my interests, and let's make a deal. And that is also something that Donald Trump is capable of.
So in some of your recent work, you've explored the expansion of the India-China relationship, which you've described in interviews as being characterized by not trust, but a convergence of interests. Can you talk a bit about what you mean by this?
So in terms of the most important relationship, clearly, in the world is between the world's number one power and the world's number two power, between the United States and China. But the second most important relationship is between the world's number two power and the world's number two power, which today is China, and the number three power, which today is India. Of course, Indian economy is still much smaller than China's economy. It's still about one-fifth the size. But nonetheless, I think India is acknowledged as the third most important pole in the world today. And actually, for most of in the first 20 years of the 21st century, relations between China and India were stable or positive under Prime Ministers Manmohan Singh and Prime Minister Narendra Modi. In fact, Prime Minister Modi had spent more hours talking to Xi Jinping than he had to any other leader. But of course, we had a very unfortunate incident in Galwan in June 2020, where both Chinese and Indian soldiers lost their lives fighting each other, barefisted or with wooden clubs. And that was very sad. And that set back China-India relations for several years until the recent breakthrough at the BRICS meeting in Russia in October 2024. So right now, the China-India relationship seems to be stabilizing. And I think one of the reasons why it is stabilizing is that both China and India realize that their number one priority should be to grow their economies. And the best way they can grow their economies is for them to cooperate with each other. So for example, India wants to become a manufacturing power, and that's a legitimate aspiration on the part of India. But to become a manufacturing power, whether you like it or not, you have to get many of your components, if not most of your components, from the country which is the manufacturing power in the world, which is China. So for some time, India was trying to restrict trade with China, and it found that by restricting trade with China, it ended up not being able to develop its manufacturing sector. So there is a convergence of interests if both sides decide that economic development is the priority. And if economic development is the priority for India and for China, the best way they can promote it is by working together in many economic fields, including in manufacturing.
And how does the current relationship, or the evolving relationship between India and China, challenge the conventional or historical wisdom on great power relations, especially in relation to the US?
Well, I mean, it doesn't challenge the great power theory because, you know, in geopolitics, it's very simple. The enemy of your enemy is my friend. So when China-India relations became bad after 2020, the United States immediately saw India as a wonderful geopolitical opportunity. So as you could tell, for a few years, there was a love affair between the United States and India. And it's interesting because if you go back to what I said about the Cold War, even though at that time, even though the United States touts it as a relationship within the world's largest democracies, which is what it is, at the same time, during the Cold War, when India was allied with, aligned with the Soviet Union, the relationship between the two largest democracies was very bad. And in fact, the United States even sent an aircraft carrier and the naval vessels to threaten India when India supported the liberation of Bangladesh in 1971. So this is not about values. It's not about whether or not you're a fellow democracy. It's about geopolitics, is about interests and about the simple rule that the enemy of my enemy is my friend. But of course, now you have a situation where relations between China and India are stabilizing, hopefully. And then it's not so clear that it is in India's interest to be completely aligned with one side or the other. In fact, if you look at the best place for India to be as a third power, if you can imagine a seesaw with the United States on one side and China on the other side, the best place for India to sit or stand is to be in the middle of the seesaw. So wherever it puts its foot changes the balance in the power balance. And that way it can extract maximum dividends from both China and the United States. So there are some shrewd geopolitical thinkers in India. And I think some of them are arguing that instead of aligning with one side or the other, India is being better off being friends with both and cooperating with both.
And my next question has just two small parts. So looking at Southeast Asia, how should our listeners understand the role of the region within the greater context of the US-China conflict? And is it even appropriate to try to understand Southeast Asia within this context? Or is there another framing which might be more suitable? Thank you.
Well, I think Southeast Asia is one of the most underestimated regions on planet Earth, because there's no region on planet Earth which is as diverse as Southeast Asia is, because after all, there are almost 700 million people in Southeast Asia. You have 250 million Muslims, 150 million Christians, 150 million Buddhists, and among the Buddhists, you have the Mahayana Buddhists, the Hinayana Buddhists, you have the Taoists, the Confucianists, the Hindus, and we also have lots of communists in Southeast Asia. Now, if there was one part of the world that should have emerged as the Balkans of Asia, it should have been Southeast Asia because of its tremendous diversity across several dimensions, ethnicity, religion, culture, language, and so on and so forth. But what's amazing is that the Balkans of Asia has emerged as an oasis of peace and prosperity in Asia, and indeed provided the platform for the great powers, both inside Asia and outside Asia, to come and meet. So I think if the US and China did an objective evaluation of the role and influence of Southeast Asia, they would realize it's actually in their interest to continue to see ASEAN thrive as a kind of an independent pole in a multipolar world, and not try and force US and China, not force ASEAN to take sides vis-a-vis US and China. But of course, this requires geopolitical wisdom. And one lesson I've learned after studying geopolitics for over 50 years is that geopolitical wisdom is a rare quality. And as a result of it, you'll find that there will always be the efforts by Washington, D.C. and Beijing to nudge ASEAN to take one side or the other in this contest. And I think that will be very unwise for both United States and China, they should recognize that actually what ASEAN is doing in terms of providing political stability, geopolitical stability and economic growth is actually beneficial for both of them. And they should try, both of them should try and work with ASEAN and strengthen ASEAN rather than to try and push ASEAN into the divisive geopolitical contest.
Well, that leads really well into my next question, which is looking at your work on ASEAN and its recent actions, how do you see its role evolving in the new international system?
Well, I think the world today, as you know, is a troubled place. You have this very painful open wounds in Ukraine and in Gaza. And people keep thinking that, hey, you know, in our troubled world, there's no way in which countries that have opposing interests or opposing views can work together or get along with each other. And this is where you need to demonstrate that actually in our modern contemporary world, countries with significant historical differences and cultural differences can get along and can work with each other. And therefore, ASEAN can serve as a role model for many, many countries in the world. And I can tell you that what's interesting is that people in many corners of the world are beginning to be aware of ASEAN. Just last week, I got a phone call from a successful Silicon Valley entrepreneur who asked to speak to me about ASEAN. So I said, how did you find out about me? He said, I went to ChatGPT and asked ChatGPT, tell me, what is the best book on ASEAN? And ChatGPT replied, it's The ASEAN Miracle by Kishore Mahbubani and Jeffrey Sung, my co-author. And so that to me was a heartening sign that when people around the world are looking for good news to counterbalance the sort of the bad news that we seem to be drowning in, ASEAN is a huge reservoir of good news that the world should pay attention to, because it's quite remarkable that even though ASEAN's economy is one-fifth the size of the European Union, ASEAN did more to grow the global economy between 2010 and 2020 than the European Union did. You know, that's amazing. So there are amazing, amazing positive things happening in the world, and a lot of them in ASEAN, and that's why the world should pay more attention to ASEAN.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much. That's the end of my substantive questions. Just before we finish, I want to give you the opportunity if there's any new work or any new books or anything you'd like to direct our listeners' attention to. Thank you.
Well, I would say that, you know, I hope that in my latest book, Living the Asian Century, which is essentially my autobiography, I tried to explain how much Asia has traveled in my lifetime. Because when I grew up as a child in Singapore, which everyone now associates Singapore as one of the most successful tiger economies in the world. But when I grew up as a child in Singapore, our per capita income then in the 1950s and 60s was the same as Ghana in Africa, about $500. I lived in a house without a flush toilet. When I went to school at the age of six, I was put on a special feeding program because I was technically undernourished. And I used to live in a neighborhood where the gangsters would fight each other with broken beer bottles and, you know, cut each other up. And in my book, I actually describe a scene where my father was caught in a fight with broken beer bottles and I had to escort him home. And, you know, my father also, you know, ended up in jail. And so I had a very typical third world childhood experience. And what's amazing is that in my lifetime, Singapore has gone from being one of the poorest countries in the world to now becoming one of the richest countries in the world with a per capita income that is now much higher than the United Kingdom and also even higher than the United States of America. Now, that transformation of Singapore, which I've experienced in my lifetime, is something that is going to be experienced by hundreds of millions, if not billions, of Asians. And just to give you one statistic, if you add up the population of what I call the CIA countries, CIA is not Central Intelligence Agency. CIA is China, India, and ASEAN. The total population of China, India, and ASEAN is 3.5 billion people, about 40% of the world's population. And in the year 2000, there were only 150 million people enjoying middle-class living standards out of 3.5 billion. But by 2020, that number had exploded to 1.5 billion. So, you know, increase of 10 times in 20 years. And by 2030, the number could hit 2.5 to 3 billion. So never before in human history have we seen such a massive upliftment of living standards of humanity. I've never seen that ever before. So I, in my book, Living the Asian Century, try to explain how Singapore traveled this journey and frankly, where Singapore has gone in the last 20, 30 years is where the rest of Asia is going to go in the next 20 to 30 years. So if you want to get a glimpse of the future of Asia, read Living the Asian Century.
Thank you so much. Well, that's something our listeners definitely should check out, and we'll link to that in our show notes. Just remains for me to say, Professor Kishore Mahbubani, thank you so much for speaking to The Ballpark today.
My pleasure.
Professor Kishore Mahbubani is Distinguished Fellow at the Asia Research Institute at the National University of Singapore. And that's it for this episode of The Ballpark. Thanks to Professor Kishore Mahbubani for joining us in this episode. For more information about the Phelan US Centre, you can go to www.lse.ac.uk/United-States. On X and Instagram, we're at @LSE_US, and on LinkedIn, we're at LSE United States. This episode of The Ballpark was produced by Chris Gilson and Anderson Tan. A theme tune is by Ranger and the Rearrangers, a Seattle-based gypsy jazz band. You can look them up at rangerswings.com. To listen to all our previous episodes, just enter LSE Ballpark into your search engine of choice. You'll find us. We're free to listen to, and unlike lots of other podcasts, we're ad-free. We'd really love to hear what you think about the show. You can email us any feedback at uscenter@lse.ac.uk, or you can send us a tweet at @LSE_US, and tell your friends about us. If you like what you've heard, then please rate and review us via your podcast platform. It really helps other people to find the show. The content and opinions expressed in this podcast do not reflect those of the Phelan US Centre or the London School of Economics. Thanks for listening!